Welcome to BizRocket Radio with Stone Payton and John Baker. John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation. And now, get ready for BizRocket Radio. Here's Stone Payton and John Baker.
Welcome to BizRocket Radio. This is John Baker, and we are here once again on a beautiful day in Atlanta, nice and warm and warming up even more quickly. So today, our show is centered around businesses, and in particular, business transition, selling, transitioning a business, and then also we're hoping to get into some business strategy as well. We have a room full of experience. It's a little intimidating in here. There's all these powerful people in their powerful suits, and I'm looking around here shaking in my boots. But I think I'll get through it. So our first guest is Jim McCarver, and Jim is the president of Sharp. And I met Jim 3 or 4 months ago, and hit it off, and he's got some great experiences in actually selling a business here very recently. Right, Jim?
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about your background and kind of how you came to where you are now.
Well, the background is that I was with Xerox right out of college. Most of my background has been in the imaging area. And then I went to work for Savin and had different titles at Savin, ending up being a vice president of a region. Then I went to Icon Office Solutions. And the last position I had there was I was marketplace president in Atlanta, Georgia. And from that, I decided to start my own business in 1997. And that company was DocuTeam and now is Sharp Business Systems of Georgia.
And that acquisition was when?
4-1 of this year. Or excuse me, 2-1 of this year, February 1st of this year.
So you're right out of the gates.
Yeah, very recent.
All right, so we're going to get some good dirt from you, right?
I hope so,
right. So our second guest is Vince Gerzo, and Vince is a principal and also has served as president, CEO, and board member of several mid-size corporations. I've known Vince for a good bit as well through Kettering and seen him lots of times. So I appreciate you coming on. Maybe a little bit of background, Vince, on you.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for asking me to join you. And it is a pretty august group, so I hope I can hold up my own. Originally an engineer by training, I spent about 20 years or so in the corporate environment doing just about every job you can do in a corporation. Sales, marketing, manufacturing, research, new products, etc. Moved to private companies about 20 years ago, succeedingly more senior positions and eventually into private equity and smaller private companies, running a couple of them mid-size as president, CEO, serving on the boards. Raised some capital, was managing director of a boutique private equity firm. Of late, I've been consulting on an ad hoc basis. Last year, I helped a small owner-operator stabilize his business and then sell it. Essentially, it's a sell-side advisor in an asset sale. And I guess I've seen transactions from a 360-degree perspective, everything as small as a $6 million transaction and well into the hundreds of millions of bucks, before, during, after.
So all right. Well, we look forward to getting some input from you. Our third guest is Richard Morgan, Esquire. He's an attorney, but he says he's a good guy. So I'm not sure if we'll believe that, but, you know, we're going to try.
Oxymoron.
That's right. Thanks for having me. My background is basically went to University of Georgia in 1980, accounting undergrad law, and got my master's of tax law from Emory over about 4.5 years in night school. Started out as the head tax attorney at a kind of boutique business law firm. And then I went to work for a tax boutique firm, about 13 tax lawyers that specialized in estate planning for the ultra-wealthy all over the country, billionaires, 100-millionaires, and the like. And then in about 1995, I started my own practice. And so now we have a two-attorney, kind of a high-end estate planning boutique firm. And part of that practice is business succession planning. A lot of our clients own closely held companies, and we help them with those companies and all aspects of it.
All right. So after you sell the business, you help make sure that the family keeps the resources for the business.
Yes. Part of our deal, if you look at what estate planning is, it's all about enabling you to control things that you can no longer control, either because of incapacity or death. And because we are tax specialists, we can help in all aspects of that from A to Z. And that includes helping people deal with their lives as well as what happens when they're gone and taking care of their families.
Okay, perfect. And then our last guest is David Shavzin. And David is the president of his own company doing consulting. So, David, welcome in. A little background on you.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me this morning. My background started out in banking and finance, financial services. One of my first jobs early on out of school was with the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, also known as Freddie Mac, which has gotten a lot of bad publicity perhaps over the years, but it was quite a long time ago, and some really good experience on the finance side as well as on operations. Then I had the opportunity to spend about a dozen years with a large corporate entity, $20 billion life sciences firm, and had the pleasure of working in France with them for about 4 years, working in corporate finance and a lot of mergers and acquisitions work. So at the high end, the large end of that kind of M&A activity, a lot of global work. So it was a lot of work around not just two companies buying and selling, but trying to negotiate between the Germans and the French or the Spaniards and the Americans or whatever it happened to be.
It can always be fun, right?
Lots of stories on that. Yeah. That got me back here.
Careful, I'm going to hold you to that.
That got me back to Atlanta. I spent another 8 years with them, more in an operational role, so hands-on finance operations for one of our North American subsidiaries, doing all kinds of really oversight for all those kinds of all the finance and operations pieces of the company operationally, and then a whole lot of project work around got everything from ISO to just software implementations to process improvement. And I jumped out in about 2000, so about 12 years ago, to create my own consulting practice and kind of moved down somewhat like Vince into typically smaller companies, and really with a focus around helping them achieve their goals, those long-term strategic goals, whether they be focused around exit or other significant objectives that they had, helping them work to it and execute well.
So in your business, David, when do you typically have people that are coming to you for help? Are they usually coming after the fact when they got a problem, or do you find that people come to you ahead of time to really do the strategic planning and figure out what it is that they need to try to focus on?
I would say it's a mix. I'm smiling here. All too often, it's once there's a problem, unfortunately, because that takes a whole lot more time, money, effort, et cetera, as opposed to doing it right the first time. But I would say it's a mix. It's probably half and half. Typically, when I have people coming to me, it's often another strategic advisor of theirs. And so they get that advice to actually do something, and often that's early enough on. Sometimes it's not quite early enough on, but
never seems to be early enough.
Yeah, unless they're about to go out of business the next day, we'll work with them in either case.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about how do you figure out when to do this, and let's focus on kind of a transition of a business. If you're starting a business, and Jim, you've got great experience in this, and Vince probably lots of experience in this as well. You're starting a business. Do you go into it thinking, how am I going to sell this thing? Or do you go into it just figuring out, how am I going to get this thing off the ground?
You should actually. The better exits that I've seen actually had owners that contemplated the exit as they formed the business. They built into their structure, their business model, the parameters that a prospective buyer would consider. Now, that's rare. Usually, it's a health event or a real bad day at the office or an external market downturn that causes people to consider exit. But the better planned exits are the ones that someone's thinking about this long in advance.
Jim?
I, too, think you need to start thinking about it early on, whether you've got a complete plan in place. But I think you need to know what your thoughts are and start moving in that direction, and then deciding what your business, what the metrics will be for you to exit, and then trying to deliver on those metrics to make sure that when that time comes, when you're ready to either get players involved, that you've actually, your business is healthy and vibrant, and you're not selling based on having to.
Right. And you started the business really from the ground up in 1997, I think you said?
Yes.
And what were the biggest challenges, and when did you really start looking at, hey, maybe I need to think about an exit strategy with this business?
Actually, I think it was when we started in 1997 and we were sued by the company that we left, which was Icon. So it started out with we were on the opposite end of a horseshoe. It seemed like the horse was kicking us. But, you know, I think we probably started when we started to have people interested in buying us, which was probably a year or two into the business. And I kept thinking, you know, what are you buying?
Right.
It's not built.
Right.
But I think we started thinking about it then, and we had one partner that was thinking about it very seriously. But it was not, again, we weren't built, and we never felt like we were at the stage where we could even consider something of that nature at that point.
David, you in the consulting role, do you find that people are looking at this concept of an exit strategy early enough, or are they behind the eight ball?
Never early enough. I think, as Vince had said, it's very, very rare that they're thinking as they're creating the company. Now, what I see mostly is when they do start thinking about it, it's, hey, I want to get out next week or next month. You know, and then there's very little anybody can do to build that value, and the timing isn't great, and that'll impact what the sale price is. I have one client who was just great. They had not started thinking about exit at the beginning, but when they did, they were looking at it with a very healthy time frame. So we had 5-7 years to really start doing some of the planning and work towards that, put in place some of the really what will look nice to a potential advisor. The other element we added into that particular case was we started building one other option for the exit of the senior partners, and that was junior partners, which was an internal potential eventual sale.
So an internal sale of the
as opposed
company.
To outside. Yeah. So keeping options open.
And Richard, on the tax side, what are things that people aren't thinking about that maybe they should be if they're looking at an eventual sale of a business from a tax standpoint?
It's a good question. The way we look at it is we take anyone as they come. And some of our clients we've had a very long time. A lot of them have closely held businesses. Some of them we meet for the first time. I guess what I would say is we talk to our clients and we consider with them where they are in their business life cycle. Where are they in terms of retirement? How long do they want to be there? How long do they want to stay? Are there family members they would like to send it down to, or no, they're going to be giving it to either executives in the company or they're going to be going out to third parties. And we kind of go through all those options with them. And so it's just a case-by-case basis. And the tax ramifications are basically the technical structuring of any option they choose. And so we'll help them structure it so they get the best tax result.
And not to get into the weeds on this, but what are some of the options that they might have?
There's varied, if they're going to give it down to their children, they're going to success down to their children. There's many ways. Right now, there's the 2010 Tax Act. We have another 8 months left where you can gift up to $5.12 million. Husband and wife, you can double that. So there's the ability to shift wealth for free, and then you can plan how much they want to get back to retire on, and so you can make part of that a sale. So it's get back a promissory note, executive get back consulting compensation. There's different ways to get that done from an accession perspective. And there's different ways, if you have other partners, one easy way to do that, if you're going to stay there till basically the maker takes you back, then you can have insurance and a buy-sell agreement. It makes it pretty simple. You just pay for insurance and you're good to go, and makes it pretty simple. If you can sell it to a third party, you look at things like, you know, asset purchases, stock purchases, and different ways to structure those deals to maximize the tax benefits. And the deal with the tax issues is what you try and do is maximize at the end of the day what the parties get with the least off the top to the government as possible.
Dave, Vince, I'm sorry.
There's a very subtle point here, and I think this is illustrative. Long lead times are critical because an exit is really not an exit transaction is not an event. It's a process. And in spooling up all of the aspects of legal, financial, business model, many, many people address that. The one subtlety that I've seen a couple of times work against an exiting owner was the emotional side of it. There they are in the process of selling off their life's work or a significant component of that. And that has a very subtle way of impacting decisions as they get made. So it's absolutely critical for an owner-operator of a company to select his advisors early and let them negotiate the deal and sit in the sidelines, because it's asymmetrical emotion. If the owner-operator's at the table, it's their baby, it's their legacy, it's all of that, and the buyers are just sitting there, you know, as one of the four transactions they're working on that week.
Right. So, I'm sorry.
Just a quick comment and a corollary just to what Vince was saying is what goes along with that, along with the emotion also, is some idea of, in their mind, what the company is worth, which is usually much, 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 much higher than it actually is worth. So you also need those advisors to take the emotion out of that as well.
Well, let's talk about that team. If you're putting together a team from a transitionary standpoint, what are some of the key players, Jim, that you put together or brought together to try and make that transition make sense for you guys?
It wasn't so much a team as it was picking a company that we felt like knew our industry inside and out and could help us negotiate, because we felt like we needed to have multiple options. This person and his company, knowing our industry inside and out and assisting most people in their exit, I think was terrific. And because you get caught up in some of the angst when you start negotiating these things and you may be working for them, I think it's great to have an outside company that's negotiating the contract, because there are going to be times when you're going to feel like you've got an anvil coming down on you, or you're going to put an anvil against them, because there's going to be some times when you really are kind of against each other. And I think to negotiate that's difficult. So what we tried to do was, and I think we succeeded, we found a company that was probably the best in our industry. And I knew this person from my Icon days because he had done 300 acquisitions for them. So he knew all the places that you needed to look. He knew how you had to prepare your company for sale. And one of the biggest things we wanted to do was to make sure that we had two or three bidders at the same time, knowing that if we did that, we would probably get the highest multiple, and then be able to pick the culture that best suited us for our employees and for the owners.
When you talk about kind of the beginning stages of that, and we talked about it's never too early to think about it, but when you're really saying, okay, we're going to look for a suitor for this company, how long before the actual transaction did you really ramp things up and get aggressive about getting the company ready to sell?
I actually think it's, in our industry, perhaps a couple of years, because we wanted to make sure that our metrics were as good as they could be. We wanted to make sure that our revenue growth and our EBITDA was as high as it could possibly be. And we knew that we had some work that was necessary in those areas. And we knew we also needed to probably go out and get some consultants to come in and help us and assist us to get there. So from our perspective, even though this was not a succinct plan, I think 2 years in advance was probably good for us, because we saw the appreciation of our company through the metrics of our industry and through making sure that we were probably in a prime position for us to sell.
And Vince, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that's a good, putting a good stake in the ground. A couple of years run-up is critically important. Especially if it is going to be sale to a third party that's not well known. At the end of the day, the ability to build trust with your advisors is going to be critical as you're in the closing negotiations, because, as I said, it's asymmetric emotionally. And when it's the legacy of your what you've built, if it's the who's going to take care of Mike in the mailroom, and what are they going to do with that facility that I built, those things weigh very heavily, and I've seen them distort judgment rather remarkably at the closing table. So 2 years is an excellent way to do it, prepare emotionally, to develop the trust with your advisors, and then, for goodness sakes, to let them run the process.
Yeah, I was going to add just an interesting comment. We talked about in the very specific situation, and the way we're discussing this is assuming a single owner of that business. I would just add, if listeners out there are thinking about this and there's more than one partner in the business, two or three or four, I mean, think about the complexities and the emotion all flowing into this. And I haven't seen a business yet where everybody's in sync just on day-to-day activity. So that two-year runway might be 3 years, depending on how those partners are getting along, where their own minds and directions and visions are.
Good point.
And how long and how much in sync they are today. And that takes a lot of work and a lot of doing, which, again, good, competent outside advisors can help manage.
Jim, you had a partnership relationship in your transition. How did you find that experience?
I think that's a good point. I think early on, perhaps we weren't as congruent as we should have been. But as the process started to proceed, I think we got much more involved and much more congruent in our thoughts and ideas about what we wanted to do. And as we got our advisor involved and as we drove our metrics up, I think as they saw the reality of this starting to become a vision that they could see perhaps a year out, then I think they all came on board and said, okay, I'm in. If we can get the metrics to a certain level and we can get the right suitor, then and I had another majority partner and a minority partner, and then we were all very much in sync.
In going through this transition, what are some of the pitfalls that you have found? If you had to do it again, or when you do it again, what would you advise people to really look out for?
Clean up your balance sheet.
Because someone's going to be looking at it pretty
closely,
right?
Somebody's going to be scrubbing it pretty hard and wondering what you're doing with a 60-foot boat in an industrial services company.
The IRS didn't catch you, so what's...
that's not generally a problem if you're not depreciating the asset. If you start depreciating the asset, then the IRS is probably going to ask you questions. But if you're not depreciating that 60-foot boat inside your industrial services company, probably let that slide. But all kidding aside, there are aspects of the financial and capital structure that really do need to be contemplated. It's like the old gunfighter that always checked the way out before they went in. That's probably the most sound piece of advice. We've talked about a transition here, and it sounds like it was a how to do it right kind of a transition. It's shocking how many folks don't clean up stock that's owned by an estranged spouse before they try and do an exit strategy. Try to negotiate your way around that one.
Well, yeah, from an estate planning standpoint, I would imagine that's not very easy either, eh?
No. As I said, we take them as they come, and we deal with lots of issues, but we've seen everything.
So, Richard, in the transition of these resources, what, as a business owner, do you need to be thinking about from an estate planning standpoint and maybe from a personal tax standpoint that, you know, maybe is not normal or it's really changed right. The way that your estate really is made up?
Right. The best thing, I guess the number one thing you need to think about in dealing with estate planning is kind of like that the gunslinger example. You got to think about the end game. Where do you want to end up? What do you want to have happen at the end of the day? How do you want to take care of your family at the end of the day? And there's lots of different ways to do that. Good ways, bad ways, ways that will cause disputes, ways that will be tax-free, asset-protected, and no disputes. So there's lots of different options that you can make. And it's the structuring and the thinking through that process that's most important. So the key is to think about that in advance, structured in advance, so it all works out very smoothly.
One of the things I was thinking about, John, is I think a lot of people don't think about when the due diligence is done on your company that you're actually doing some due diligence on the other company, because I think you've got to know a lot about your suitor or suitors because it's going to help you in the process. There are cultures that would not be symmetrical. There'd be cultures that would not ever work. So I think at the same time, one of the things that we tried to do was to make sure that not only when the company that bought us was looking at us, we were also looking at the other companies to make sure that we understood that it was going to work and it would be a safe harbor for our employees as well as the metrics in terms of the owners didn't change much, but in terms of the cultures and making sure there was a safe harbor for the employees, it was a big deal, I think, and oftentimes probably overlooked.
Let's talk a little bit about the employee piece of that, because obviously with these companies, a lot of times when you're selling to the larger organization, there are fears that the employees have, and obviously the employees are a integral part of the valuation of that business. If they all go away, you know, you kind of don't really have the same experience that you had before. What are some of the things that you need to do to help those employees get through that transition and make sure that they're taken care of?
Well, early on, I think no matter what happens and no matter who gives the speeches, whether it's the company that's purchased you, their president, or you, or both of you, there's going to be some angst until the employees find out that they're a part of the go forward plan. And until they personally know that there is something in this for them, they're going to be concerned. And they're going to be lined up outside somebody's door, either HR's or my door or somebody else's. So I think, you know, the quicker you can calm people down, because they've heard all kind of stories that people say nothing's going to change. And then 6 months later, they look back and the whole culture of the company has changed. So I think the first month or so, we were into damage control. You know, even our top people wondered what the new company was going to look like, whether they were going to be as big a part of the future as they'd been in the past. And I think, you know, there was a lot of, as I said, angst, because until they can see that the new company coming on board has bought you for a reason, and that they can show that if in fact they said there's not going to be any changes, that there's not going to be many, and that the culture is going to stay primarily the same, and that their position is solid, then I think there's going to be some concerns. So we had to work very quickly to make sure that all the disciplines inside our company and all the different, like, service, sales, and administration, that all three of those groups knew in private meetings and then separate meetings with each individual employee as they needed it, to make sure that they understood that their role going forward was equally as important as it had been in the past.
John, I was just going to just add, from a communication standpoint, and I've seen this over and over again with acquisition or divestiture, we try to keep it secret. You know, I'm working in a $20 billion company. We've got 150 people working on this, and we think it's going to be secret. And then you start offering it to three or four or five potential buyers, and you think it's going to be secret. So one way or another, even if you can't get across full communication so early on, you've got to acknowledge to your own staff to maintain that trust so they don't start jumping ship. And actually torpedo the acquisition if you're losing your key people, because you've not been keeping them in the loop and they're hearing things from elsewhere.
Yeah. And the other key element to that is you need to treat people as adults. If you know something, you tell them you know it. If you think something, you tell them you think it. If you're not sure, you tell them you're not sure. It is an emotional roller coaster as you're part of the group going with the deal, or worrying if you're going with the deal. But at the end of the day, being straight up and communicating clearly the knowns, the unknowns, the uncertainties. And there's another aspect of the due diligence process, that to the degree that there are those folks that are concerned about their positions are involved, you can assist your folks by yourself doing diligence on the acquirer's history of deals, and use that as a criteria on which to position questions.
Actually, that was another question that I had surrounding, how do you know? A company might say, look, nothing's going to happen that's different, and you're kind of selling that to your employees. Do you recall, or from your experiences, do you recall the time that something happened, you said, this is not going the way they said it would, or an indicator that said, you know what, things are moving the way they should? What was that indicator, or what was that experience that kind of said, yep, it's moving in the right direction, or nope, it's really not?
The indicator for us was when, because the most sensitive to all this, I think, are salespeople, because they're like high-performance cars, very sensitive to change and any kind of different change in gasoline or whatever. So once the sales reps started to see, and our high performers started to see that, that the acquirer wanted to change the culture to ours, and that's what they said, but they weren't sure that they were sincere about it until they saw that the compensation plan, they could either choose the one of the acquirers or ours. Either way, it was up to them. I think once they saw that that was going to stay pretty much the same, and a lot of our paperwork and things that we had to process through leasing companies and all that stayed the same. I think once they saw that in practice for a couple of months, there were very little changes, because they were definitely looking for the changes to be negative, for sure. But I think once the sales reps saw that very little of their sandbox was being changed, then I think they were much more positive about the subsequent changes.
Yeah, if they fill out just different paperwork, you can throw them for a loop completely, right?
Yeah, or filling out any paperwork. Yeah. Some of them don't like to fill out any paperwork.
No, I think most of them don't like to fill out paperwork.
Sure.
Well, again, on a broader perspective, having to watch whether the folks on the other side, if the audio matches the video, if they say they're going to do something, do they do it? If you agree in a conference call with the business principals on certain elements, and the attorneys turn the documents and you get them back and the audio didn't match the video, there's a yellow flag. And the second time that happens, you're probably talking to the wrong folks. And you can also see it in some instances where senior executives exiting owners, may not exit. There may be a consultancy. There may be an employment agreement. Watch carefully in the context of that agreement, again, whether the audio matches the video. And if it doesn't, you got the wrong folks at the table.
So now we've transitioned the business, okay? And now you're trying to merge these two organizations and their philosophies, and you're trying to create strategic opportunities to move forward and everybody kind of win from this process. What was the biggest challenge in going through and developing strategies between two companies that really now have merged into really one ideal?
Actually, from our perspective, I don't think that the culture changed much, so there were subtleties. And because they could pick and choose some of the things from the new company versus the old company, I think when they were given those options, they realized perhaps that they had a culture where they were listening and perhaps where they really did want to change the whole metrics of the acquiring company to be more like ours. But I think until they start to see some communication and some actual lack of changes and things staying status quo, they're all going to be concerned that whatever was said at the celebration is going to be perhaps not accurate.
Yeah, and I was going to add, too, I think when you look at the organization, part of it is not change, but the other alternative is some positive change all around. And one of the things I like to see, and a lot of what we're talking about, too, I would say is very valid just in any ongoing company in terms of their planning and how they're dealing with their people. But in that acquisition mode, and you're bringing those two cultures together and two groups of people, getting them working together at every level and contributing at every level and talking to each other at every level from the two prior companies. Look at how things are done and don't assume the acquirer's company's processes are the best, right? We're going to do everything that way. To the extent you can put people in a room and say, what's the best out of both sides and create a new best, I think is pretty important.
In a leadership position, how do you do that?
It's easy to dislike people at a distance when you don't really understand them, or I should say easier. And sometimes it's very easy to dislike people when they're close up. But in this context, putting together working groups, smaller working groups, and the customer service function from the acquired facility is now going to work with the customer service function, and seek best process. And usually that kind of a dynamic helps. It relieves a lot of the us versus them. Going into the transition plan is something that the successful companies I've seen do it, and when we were successful, we had literally a 90-day plan for integrating, and part of that integration was to integrate the team and on a working level. And sometimes the it's astounding how dysfunctional communication can be when you're only over the phone. So spend a few extra bucks, get people in the same conference room, structure it, and see if you can get them to come to a common new way of doing it. And a lot of that stuff goes away.
Jim, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there was a lot of positives that came out of our transition. You know, we were 165 employees. When we merged into the bigger corporation, Sharp, the benefits were a third the cost. to people that were making less income. That was a major benefit. And I think when the corporate people came down from New Jersey, they were so good at listening. I think a lot of times if people come in, they just want to throw up every bit of information they've ever learned their whole life. And I think they were sensitive about saying, you know, when we get in small groups and we're communicating, these are people, and they're probably a little nervous. So they were terrific with their not only body language but communication skills. And, hey, look, the only reason we bought your company is because we know that the employees are great and that you guys have consistency in the mission statement, those kind of things. So I think once they started to see those things materialize, and when the people came down, because it was a covey of people, I mean, it was like the first month, we had so many visitors to our company that it was incredible. But I think once they realized those visitors were there to help, and they really were, and part of it was to make sure that they saw that, you know, these people are nervous, and so they took it at their pace versus just trying to, you know, just give them all the information in one setting and have them try to digest it. So they were very good at that, better than I ever thought they could be. Because a lot of times, big corporations can't get out of their own way, let alone have a sensitivity to a little company that they've acquired to become a part of a big company.
And it may sound a bit manipulative, but as an acquirer of a smaller entity, I always thought it was pretty clear-headed to look for either a business line or a strategy that was coming from the acquired company and exploit that. Make them feel like they have made a contribution to the big acquirer. And there's still a little bit of that intramural pride about, we showed the big guys. And it may sound manipulative, but any acquirer who thinks they know how to do everything better, you show me that, I'll show you a damn fool.
Yeah, there's no reason to acquire if you...
Bingo.
That, right? So, Richard, kind of transitioning into a new business and... understanding that there are business continuation issues that you've had in an old company and now being acquired and there's new ownership. A lot of times there's stock or there's acquisition of the current company that just, or there's shares of the current company that just bought you. How do you rejigger the whole business continuation piece of that?
It's a good question. Basically, they're all, that whole deal is going to change. So it all comes down to what is the deal. And one of the points I was going to make from just listening to everybody here was that the sellers need to understand the terms. And what I tell my clients is, and the way I review documents, is I want them to fully understand what this means. And it's nice if someone tells you and shakes your hand and tells you how great it's going to be. It's something else. For example, you have a consulting agreement, but you can be fired at will, and your agreement goes away. So you need to make sure that you understand the terms and what they mean practically to you, and so there's no surprises. And if they stick one in your back, well, you knew it was a possibility anyway, so you're not really that shocked.
It's kind of like the Facebook movie, right?
Yes.
I always remember that in Facebook and thinking, you better have good attorneys to look over this stuff.
Right.
See, I might interject a point. One of the things that we thought was going to be real positive to our employees turned out to be a negative, and that was that we made the announcement, the acquirer did, that we would be around for at least 3 years. They wanted us to be there 5 years, but that we had agreed and I'd agreed to do a three-year with a two-year look. And we thought that was going to be positive, and they go, well, 3 to 5 years goes by pretty quick. What are we going to do then? And I'm going, if you knew that something was locked in for 3 to 5 years, typically today you take that deal, right?
Right.
So there was still a lot of people go, well, that's not long enough.
Right. Right. What else, Richard? What other kinds of things are out there that people should look for, you know, going through that transition, new documents and things they really need to be aware of?
Well, the reality is you're going to have a buyer, unless there's an equal merger, you're going to have a buyer, and then the buyer is going to take over. So a lot of those plans, employee benefit plans, or maybe some transition where you have the old and the new, and eventually they kind of freeze the old ones with the employees that were there before. But you're basically going to end up with the seller's benefit packages and agreements and executive continuation type of agreements. And that's just one of those things. It's just if you're going to stay there, and one of the issues going into these deals is, should you lock up certain employees so they can't leave? And if they do leave, there's going to be a downside to them so that we keep them during this transition where they may get very uptight. And 3 to 5 years may be fine for the employer, but may not be so fine for the employee who figures, well, it doesn't last that long. I got to go find someplace. I'm a valuable asset. I can go somewhere else. And there's plenty of companies out there, if you really are valuable, that they would love your skills. They're basically going to buy your skills, your client list, whatever it is. So sometimes you want to lock them up. Another thing I wanted to bring up was, and I've seen this in very large companies, where you have the acquirer, the buyer comes in and the employees basically say, this is the way we have done this forever. The acquired may be better at something, may be a lot better at something. And they say, well, but this is a better way, the best practices. And so there's a clash. And what eventually ends up happening is if they're successful, the best practices ends up prevailing. If they're not successful, then they do it as they've always done it, and you have problems. And I have seen both. The ones that are good, they have good transitions, and the just because we've always done it that way doesn't survive.
Yeah, I was going to add just back. You talked, John, about what the seller needs to be thinking about. And one thing right up, you know, your legal alley, Richard, is liability. You know, if I'm selling, I'm the seller, I want to be done with, you know, everything. I want the buyer to warranty that they're not coming after me for everything. Or if there is something that we really need to negotiate that I may still be liable for, possibly environmental, that it's very clear cut. And again, it goes back to understanding exactly what you're walking away with, not just that check with the dollar sign on it,
right,
but what else, what other baggage might be there to be very careful about.
So this next question has to do with kind of how the personal impact of going through something like this. And I think Jim and Vince, it may be very different because, Jim, this was kind of your baby. This was your baby. And, Vince, you're a hired gun for the most part. So let me start, Vince, with you. Going through these transitions, how did they impact you coming out on the other side, something that you had experienced that you didn't really have that experience or vantage point going into it?
Well, I think that if you focus on the transaction, you're missing the boat. The critical thing is to focus on the before and the after. And the emotional aspect from a personal standpoint, of working my way out of a job.
Right.
I'm going on the unemployment line.
Right.
And that the day after takes plays a much larger role in positioning one's mindset in the deal. If I'm feeling pretty good about it and I'm going to do okay myself, then I'm okay. I'm on board and I'm pushing. And there's another very, very important point. Every single employee that's affected by the transition, and we mentioned a minute ago benefit programs, don't think for a second that they're not sitting home with their wives or husbands going through that plan A and the alternative B and picking out that $57 adjustment here and the $4 adjustment there. So absolutely, the day after is critical, and getting from the transaction to the day after on a personal level makes all the difference as to whether or not they're on board for the deal, whether or not they're on board day one.
So as a hired gun, as it were, how do you set yourself up? So, and now that you know that, and you're going into this, and maybe the first time you weren't so sure that you know, that exit piece, you better be something in there for me to continue to want to push myself out of a gig. What now do you do to ensure that you have some skin in the game, enough so that you are a top performer all the way through the end of the day?
Well, I think a lot of it goes to the terms of your employment as a hired gun. And again, with advisors, you come to learn that there are transition packages, there are stay packages that can be important. In my personal experience has been the first deal I negotiated, I did a poor job. I happened to be working for some very reputable folks that took care of me. The second deal, it was a slightly different terms on the employment agreement. So there are aspects that we're seeking, again, advice from professionals, third parties who've been there, done that, and baking them into terms of transition, of outplacement in some instances, if that's important, of a benefit continuation, success bonuses. Mm-hmm. Perhaps if you negotiate a better deal on behalf of somebody else, you get a bigger slice of the transaction or something of that sort. So there are a lot of ways to make a good transition and a comfortable post-transaction environment.
Jim, what did you learn going through this transition about yourself or about about going through it as an experience?
I think one of the things was the euphoria of the wire transfer lasted until I got to the office the next morning and realized that I usually get there about 7 o'clock. About 7:15, I had a line outside my door.
So they all have their hands out?
Yeah. My wife had sent me this message at about 4 o'clock when the wire transfer, it was OMG. And so I got to celebrate that for the evening. And then the next morning, I'm in the transition of, oh, my God, meant a different thing to the employees.
Yeah.
And I had a number of people that came in and go, you know, I know this has been a great deal for you and your partner.
Yeah.
Now, what about me?
Yeah.
We had a couple people come in, and I'll tell you, it was very difficult because our top salesman literally broke down and cried in my office because he felt like he should get a portion of what we got. And there was nothing ever put in writing. So you got to realize that this is going to affect people differently. And he had talked to a number of people in advance saying, you know, well, if they ever sell this, they're going to owe me a big check.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, so you got to go through that. And then it's the transition. I think the quicker they can see that you're not changing, that if you got there at 7 o'clock or 6:30 and you didn't leave till 7 o'clock and the business changes from your standpoint are minimal.
Right.
And if anything, you're putting more into it and the energy is still there and the excitement's still there and the enthusiasm is still there because they're going to take a lot of the lead from the executives of the company who sold. And if they see those changes, then they're already starting to think about their changes and how they're going to change their life and maybe how they might change jobs.
Yeah.
In the private equity community, it's quite common to take the key employees down to usually two levels below the C level and spread either stock equivalents, or by some mechanism give them the benefit of the transaction. And it could be a slice of cash. It could be conversion into stock from the other folks. But, of course, usually, in 99% of the cases, it's a slice of the transaction so that the transaction makes everybody feel slightly richer.
Yeah, I would imagine it's a difficult a line to cross or not cross. And each individual, as you said, Jim, is very different.
And we had to take what we decided, the owners decided that key employees like our VP of sales, our VP of service, our COO, we did take care of them financially. But you have to decide how far down you take that.
Yeah, it's so hard to figure out. Again, where do you draw that line? It's a difficult thing to do.
We drew it at the senior staff level, and then we acquiesced to our top salesman by saying, look, we're not going to give cash no matter how many times he came into my office, which was many, right, and saying, I don't get
he's
it.
He's a sales guy.
Well, he's sales guy. That's the reason why he's a peddler. Yeah.
What's good about him is also bad about him. He's the most intense guy in the world. We actually end up giving him a portion of one of our buildings because we as owners own the buildings, the six buildings that we're working out of, so we gave him a vestiture in one of the buildings. It would give him some money, you know, futuristically. We give him some future money, but it also means he's got to stay on.
Right.
So we felt like that was probably a great investment on our behalf because he had he was somebody we did not want to lose, and Sharp was not going to give big stay bonuses. So we felt like that was the best way to take care of him.
And David, from your vantage point, which is kind of the broader scheme going through these things from a consulting standpoint, you've seen a lot of that kind of thing. What was your experience being from kind of the multitudes that you've seen?
Are you talking on the compensation issue?
Well, on the transition, on going through that transition and getting to the other side, and just an experience or several experiences that people have that they really didn't have before, and it's just new to them.
Yeah, I think I think the guys covered it pretty well in general. The biggest thing I think is people thinking about exactly what they're going to do the next morning when they wake up, once the check is in, the wire is in, and so on, and you know, and that the other factor that people don't think about necessarily is that when they are thinking about their situation and what's going to happen, they do have a partner, even if they don't have a partner, and that often is that spouse. What's going to happen when if the spouse not in the business hasn't been working outside the home and now they're both home 24/7, those kinds of issues as well. You know, we're all living longer, and quote unquote retirement, you might have another 30, 40 years to go. And so thinking about the personal issues and where we go from there. And it takes away a lot of the identity. You know, too often we get to be our business card. You know, I left a $20 billion company, and when I had that card and showed that card, that, you know, people knew who that was. I left and started my own practice, and it was, who the heck are you?
And how do you pronounce your last name?
Exactly. What is that? Yeah. Actually, the first incarnation of the business didn't have my name on it, and then I adjusted after a while. But
they'll never forget it, though. They'll never, yeah. Shavzin.
There you go.
It's got a good oomph to it, right?
John, one of the things that I think was unique to us is you have a tendency to start thinking, maybe overthinking, how people are going to react. And we thought that they would be very happy for us. And they were for about 10 minutes, you know, maybe a half of a break.
Yeah.
And then they're starting to think about, well, what about me?
Yeah.
And if
yeah.
they got a lot of money, shouldn't that cascade? I mean, literally, I think people were thinking that this was like, you know, everybody's going to get some piece of the action.
That's right.
So I think until you just got to know going into it that people really want to know, well, what's in it for me?
Yeah.
What's in it for me short term? What's in it for me long term? Am I going to have employment? And once they realize that, hey, there is no cascading of funds anymore, we didn't even tell them we gave money to any of our senior staff, then they realize it goes to plan B, and that's, yeah, am I going to be employed?
Get back to work again.
Yeah, what am I going to do?
Yeah, and John, and I would add, too, you know, part of the stage setting for that, hopefully, if in a well-run business, is that you are treating your folks really well all along. Salaries, bonuses, everything you can to show them that you really care about them and take their interests to heart. It's a very... It not just altruistic, but obviously it also helps the bottom line for the business. One of my clients that we worked with over several years working towards exit, they were all very, 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 very good to their folks. I mean, they paid very well in the market. They had very high standards, and their staff knew it, and they assumed and counted on them to do well. They also promoted from within very, very strongly. And one of the activities that we did over the course of planning also was to help them build some organizational development where they had been very flat, and we built in some career tracks. So a lot of those things, I think, will tend to soften some of the you know, the exit and the sort of the jealousy when that big check comes in for the senior folks. And then other things that can happen too is you talked a little bit about a slice of cash equity, but an entire across the board, you can offer different types of incentives and different levels of stock and different levels of quote-unquote ownership. The point is engaging them in the success as much as you can.
You know, Jim and I were talking prior to going on the air about that exact same thing, about, you know, before you're a smaller company and now you're creating these different levels. Did you see that people got excited about maybe career opportunities that were bigger and larger than the vision that they had before?
Initially, I did not, because I think they were trying to realize how valid all this was and what the next day would bring and all that. But I think as we started to unfold and the people from Sharp came in to try to assist us in getting up to speed on some of the changes, I think they did see that, and they realized that this is a bigger corporation, and that when you had a job opening, there was a posting for jobs throughout the country. And I think once they saw that that was more than just hyperbole, somebody saying it, then I think they were on board saying that maybe there is more of a career path than there had been from the smaller acquired company.
So we're running a little short on time. I'm going to wrap up with pearls of wisdom. So I'm just going to ask each person to really think about, you know, what they'd like to share with the audience in terms of something that they've learned either through a transitionary process or helping clients through this kind of a process, and then maybe get some contact information. So, Jim, start off.
Well, the pearls of wisdom, I think, is what did you say and what actually happened? I think, you know, employees are going to, they'll listen to what you have to say, but they're going to really watch what you do afterwards. So if you're not willing to make those changes that you're saying or not make any changes, then don't talk about them up front. I think it's the, you know, talk the talk and walk the walk. I think once they realize that the same people who had been honest with them before are still running the company, I think it was, and they had to see that in practice versus what we said. So I think the main thing is just know that until they see it in practice, they're going to have some angst, and they're going to have some concern and all that. So I think that's the one thing that we didn't we planned for it, but we also thought they would say, well, if we said it, we meant it.
Right.
But I think they realized that, hey, we now work for somebody.
Yeah.
And so we may think it, but we're not sure that they do.
Right, yeah. Right. Vince?
I think from the perspective, understand completely that an exit transaction is a process, not an event. Plan early. Get trusted advisors. I mean, heck, if you're going for surgery, you want the best surgeons you can find. So if you're selling a business, you want the best advisors you can find. Trust them. Let them do the deal with you or for you. And beware the emotional roller coaster, because it's asymmetrical with the seller and the buyer. If you're the seller, it's your baby. And then think about the day after, when you might not have to go to work again.
Right.
And
what's next?
What's next?
Yeah. I would say I'm a planner, and part of this listening to your good professionals is to fully understand what is going to happen, what the pros, what's the cons. So if something bad happens, it's like, that's life. You already knew it could happen. I would say, my partner hates me saying this, but we've never had a problem that we didn't anticipate. I can say we almost never had a problem, but I can say in a business sale, we told the client, I wouldn't do that deal because you don't have enough security if they don't pay you, because it was a seller financing. She said, well, I'm willing to do it. And, of course, they defaulted and never got paid.
Right.
So I knew it was coming. I told her it was coming, that she accepted that risk. The key to me was that she was okay with that risk, and that's life. And as long as you're okay with it, it's fine with me. I just like my clients to have their eyes wide open. That's the way I go through life. Mm-hmm. People hate negative surprises. So I would say that just keep your eyes wide open and make sure you plan in advance.
Sage advice. David.
Well, I'll pick up on planning for the future. We talk here about exit specifically and the difficulties in that. My suggestion is, whether you are thinking about exit, whether you don't want to, and so many people don't because it means getting older, maybe it means retiring, is to start planning for the long term, whatever long term means for you, even if it's not specifically an exit. Pick a time. Pick 5 years or 10 years. What does the business look like at that point? Pick some point in time and go back and take an hour a week to think about the strategy in your business and where you're headed, because we don't do that. We run around 24/7 putting fires out. So if you're heading towards exit, and by the way, exit for me can be anything from dropping dead in the business to that outside sale to the internal sale. So take the time to step back and think, whatever it is, which we don't do, and plan to some point, even if it's not full exit at that getting that magic check in the door.
Jim? One of the things that I look now is retroactively is did we do it right? Because anything you do in life, you can look at it beforehand and you feel like it hits all the criteria and all the hot buttons and all that. And now you've got to say, if I'm ever going to do this again, would I make changes? Would I get more outside counsel? Would I have more of this, more of that? How would I do this? So, one of the things I did a month or two afterwards was assess, where we had the strengths in the sale, where we had the weaknesses, and what I would do differently, because I don't plan on this being the last one. So I think that's one of the things you want to kind of keep in mind is, where did you do it right? How did you assess it? Was it on a scale of 1 to 10? Was it an 8? Was it a 7? Was it a home run? Whatever. And then pick up on the things you feel like you do better next time.
Good stuff. So let's just get contact information. Vince, if somebody wants to get in contact with you, what's the best way to reach out?
VGarzo, bellsouth.net.
Okay. Easy enough. Richard?
Our law firm is Morgan & DeSalvo. You can look us up. We're in Alpharetta, Georgia, right off 400. You can contact me email at rmm@morgandesalvo.com. And DeSalvo is DISALVO.
And David?
David Shavzin, D. Shavzin.
Spell that.
Yeah, I'm going to. D as in David, S-H-A-V as in Victor, Z-I-N, at ShavzinAssociates.com. The website is ShavzinAssociates.com. Pick up the phone, 678-795-1750. Thanks, John.
All right. And Jim?
James dot McCarter, MCCARTER, at sharpusa.com, or the phone number is 770 663-8400.
Okay. So, Jim, Vince, Richard, and David, thank you so much for your time. A great show. We really appreciate you guys coming out this morning and spending some time with us. We know your time's valuable, and we hopefully the audience got a lot out of it. So we appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoyed
thank
it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
For our audience, we appreciate your time as well. Until next week, be safe.
John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA/SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation.